final case for argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Lucas Jeffrey Wilson. For the appellant, Mr. Wilson, is Ms. Veronica Duffy, an attorney from Rapid City. For the appellate, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Craig Eichstead, Deputy Attorney General. Ms. Duffy, may proceed.
My name is Veronica Duffy, and I represent a young man by the name of Lucas Wilson in this appeal of a criminal case. I believe that this appeal presents an issue that is of utmost importance to 99% of the people sitting in the audience today, because I believe that if this court affirms the trial court in this matter, it is essentially adopting a de facto rule that police are free to roust out people between the ages of 18 and 28 for little or no reason, simply because they happen to be out driving around at an odd hour of the day. This case involves a traffic stop that was wrong from start to finish. It began with a pullover of a vehicle without a valid reason for a stop. It further continued with illegal questioning of the driver without benefit of Miranda warning. It continued with an illegal extended detention of both the defendant and the driver, Mr. Neff. The police officer then engaged in illegal questioning of my client, Mr. Wilson, again without benefit of Miranda, and concluded the traffic stop with an illegal search. I'd like to begin with the argument that this traffic stop did not have a valid basis in the law. Under South Dakota law, we require that a law enforcement officer have a, quote, specific and articulable suspicion that a traffic violation has occurred before he's allowed to pull over anybody who's driving in a car. Now, Mr. Wilson and Mr. Neff were driving in a vehicle at 7 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning up by Pactola Reservoir, which is just outside of Rapid City in Pennington County. The officer said he had two reasons for pulling this car over. One was that the vehicle had crossed the fog line, which is the line that's on the right-hand side of a driving lane. The highway in which they were pulled over is a two-lane highway. The second reason the officer said he had for pulling them over was that they had a dangling object hanging from their rear-view window. First of all, I'd like to address crossing the fog line. The officer relied on SDCL section 32-26-1 and argued that the driver had violated that provision of law when his tire crossed the fog line. SDCL 32-26-1 does not prohibit crossing the fog line on the right-hand side of the driving lane. The statute instead restricts drivers to driving on the right half of the roadway, which this driver did. He never crossed over the center line, which would have violated this provision.
What if he had two wheels in the ditch and two wheels on the road?
Your Honor, I think that then that would rise to the level of the community caretaker exception, which was raised by Mr. Eichstadt in his brief. However, the trial or the suppression hearing transcript in this matter doesn't give us those facts. In fact, the police officer changed his testimony in this case. He testified in a suppression hearing for the driver, Mr. Neff, and said that one half of one tire crossed over the fog line. Then his story got a little better when he testified in the suppression hearing in my client's case, Mr. Wilson, and he said one half of the car crossed over the fog line. At no time, however, did the car ever leave the roadway. And this is important because SDCL 32-26-1 encourages drivers of slow-moving vehicles to drive as closely as possible to the right-hand edge or curb of the highway.
A reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop doesn't require a violation of a law. There can be facts and circumstances far short of a statutory violation before reasonable suspicion arises, can there not?
I agree with that, Your Honor, but in this case, we're stuck with what the officer said his reason was for pulling these folks over. And he said that his reason for pulling these folks over was a violation of SDCL 32-26-1, which I do not believe was violated by the driver in this case. He did not fail to keep his vehicle on the right half of the roadway, which is what that statute requires.
So the officer made no statement that he thought that there was impaired driving or anything of that nature?
No, he did not, Your Honor. And if he had testified that he was concerned for the occupants, thought maybe they were undergoing an epileptic seizure or were drunk or I mean, any number of other factors that might have justified the community caretaker exception, but there's no testimony to that effect. He testified he pulled him over for two reasons and two reasons only, one being the violation of SDCL 32-26-1. The second factor that the officer relied on in stopping this vehicle was the supposed existence of a dangling object that was hanging from the rearview mirror. Now, there's a videotape that was entered into evidence in this case, and in the videotape, you can clearly see the head of the driver, the head of the passenger, my client, Mr. Wilson. There's a dog in the vehicle that's bouncing around, and you can clearly see that. You can clearly see the outlines of the rearview mirror, and you can clearly see the outlines of the brake light in the rear window of the car. Nowhere in that videotape can I discern, and I'll have to rely on your judgment in viewing that videotape, a dangling object. But more to the point, the officer's conduct at the scene belies the existence of a dangling object. He allowed the driver to re-enter the vehicle at the end of the tape and drive the vehicle back to Rapid City. He never removed anything from the rearview window of the driver's vehicle. He never asked the driver to do so. If a dangling object is a violation of law because it poses a danger to the driver in that it obscures his vision, and it's so easily remedied at the side of the road, why wouldn't the officer have asked the driver to remove that dangling object before resuming driving? The conclusion that I feel is inescapable is that the dangling object never existed.
Does he cite him for that?
He supposedly issued two warning tickets. Those warning tickets were never introduced into evidence, and they were not located in the evidence locker.
But the trial judge found that there was a dangling. I mean, the trial judge made a credibility determination and heard the officer say that there was one, that he saw one, and she believed him. I mean, how do we override that?
Your Honor, I agree I'm up against a pretty stiff standard of review here. You can only reverse on this issue if you find that Judge Kerr was clearly erroneous. I sat and listened to the arguments in the earlier case that was argued before these justices in the Colcraft case, and it struck me that if the law enforcement officer had come forward with this little evidence in a civil case, at the very least, we would have been justified in drawing an inference that that evidence would have been negative because he didn't produce it. There was no photograph of the dangling object. It was not placed into evidence. The officer's own testimony on this subject varies from time to time. One time he says there's a dangling object, singular. Another time he said there were dangling objects. Another time he testified that there were a large group of dangling objects. I always tell my witnesses when I'm preparing them to testify, tell the truth. If you tell the truth, you don't have to worry about what lies you've told, and you won't get tripped up. Just tell the truth. I think what happened here is that this fish story got better with each telling. First, one half of one tire crossed the fog line, and there was a single dangling object. Then there were a large group of dangling objects, and the car was halfway off the roadway. I don't believe that this officer's testimony was credible. The dangling object standard is so easy for law enforcement to satisfy. Anybody in this auditorium who is driving a car with a dangling object hanging from their rearview mirror is subject to being pulled over. Because that standard is so easy for law enforcement to satisfy, I believe that they have to come forward with something other than a law enforcement officer's inconsistent testimony to prove the existence of that dangling object. You all drive, and as soon as these proceedings are concluded, you'll get in your cars and drive back to your hometowns. You know that a figure approaching 50% of the cars that surround you have dangling objects from the rearview mirror. Not all of those cars are pulled over. I will not be pulled over because I drive a minivan and I'm middle-aged and I have a child's car seat in the back of my car. That is an excuse that's used by law enforcement officers to roust out people who they have a suspicion are engaging in illegal activity, but they don't otherwise have a valid constitutional basis for pulling them over.
Unless you convince the circuit court judge of that, you know, you have no expert testimony that we should accept in relation to that thing. Where can we go with that without the circuit court judge's findings, say, at least on credibility of the officer, that he claimed there was a dangling object, but I don't believe him?
I think there are a number of bases on which you can find that finding is clearly erroneous, the chief among them to be the videotape. I know the videotape is not digital and high-definition television, but there are objects that are clearly visible in that videotape. And I believe that if a dangling object were hanging from that rearview mirror, it would be clearly visible, and it's not. The second issue that proves up the unconstitutionality of this traffic stop is what I'll call the Ballard issue. It's the illegal extended detention of these people in this car. In State versus Ballard, this court held that cops cannot lie to drivers in order to falsely put them at their ease in order to get them to waive their constitutional rights to avoid warrantless searches. Now, there's a difference between lying before you waive your constitutional rights and lying after. I think the cases are clear that once you've waived your Miranda rights or once you've waived your right to disallow a search, that cops are entitled to tell you any number of lies. They can suggest that the driver rolled over on you and gave you a bunch of information and that basically they have all the goods on you and to in an effort to get you to talk. But they can't lie before the constitutional right is waived. They can't tell a lie in order to get the person to waive their constitutional rights. And that's what Ballard stands for. In Ballard, the cop had his antenna up about the driver before he ever told the lie. He had noticed that she was fidgety and that she had constricted pupils, and he believed that those indicated drug use. He had already made up his mind that he was not going to let the driver leave without searching her vehicle. But that's not what he said to her. He told her, "I'm going to write you this warning ticket, and then you'll be free to go." And why did he tell her that lie? Because he wanted to put her at ease, to lull her into a sense of complacency so that she would agree to the search. Here, the facts are exactly the same. The law enforcement officer observed the facts that led him to believe drug use was involved before he told the lie to the driver. When he first approached the vehicle, he noticed both the driver and the passenger had unlighted cigarettes in their mouths. And he said that was a big red flag to him. He thought they were trying to cover up some odor. Then when he was engaging the driver in conversation, he noticed that he was fidgety and had uncontrollable movements. And he also noted that he had constricted pupils. He then invited the driver back to his vehicle, whereupon he said, "I'm going to issue you two warning tickets for crossing the fog line and for having a dangling object, and then we'll get you on down the road." The officer testified at the suppression hearing that when he uttered those words to the driver, he intended to convey the idea that once he issued the warning tickets, the driver would be free to go. Again, as in Ballard, the officer had no intention of letting this driver go until he had searched the vehicle. That was a lie that was intended to put the driver at ease so that he would waive his constitutional rights. It was illegal under Ballard, and it's illegal here. And although De La Rosa, State versus De La Rosa, which was decided after Ballard, removed some of the Ballard protections with regard to extended detentions, it reaffirmed this part of Ballard, that officers cannot lie in an attempt to get drivers to give up their constitutional rights. I would note that as to the extended detention issue, this court has held in State versus Krebs that passengers have automatic standing to challenge the traffic stop and the extended detention, because when an officer pulls over a vehicle, it is considered to be a seizure of all the occupants of the vehicle. So Mr. Wilson has standing to raise that issue. The final issue with regard to this traffic stop that I would like
before
to talk
about. Before you get to that, and this may be unfair because it was just issued last week, but you didn't perchance see that Eighth Circuit case that came down last week.
I did not, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
On extension of a stop to get consent.
No, I assume that is addressed to the second issue in Ballard that De La Rosa essentially gutted, which is once you get response back from the people back in the office that the driver's license checks out and the vehicle registration checks out, that then you have to let him go. And under De La Rosa, they said, well, he had a drug dog right there in his car and he allowed it to circle the car. That was a minimum amount of time, and it didn't really prejudice the defendants. I am assuming the Eighth Circuit deals with that issue, which really doesn't bear on this issue. This issue deals with an officer's lie that's told in an effort to get somebody to waive their constitutional rights. The final issue that I wanted to talk about was the driver's consent to search his vehicle. When the officer was questioning Jeremy Neff, if this court holds that that was an illegal detention because the officer had lied, then Jeremy Neff's consent is per se invalid. A consent that is otherwise voluntary, that is given during an illegal detention, is invalid. And so...
Let me ask you a question now about Neff, because Neff came before a different judge. Is that right, Judge?
Yes. My client, because he acknowledged the, his ownership interest in the evidence that was seized at the scene, was arrested on the spot.
Okay.
The driver was allowed to go free. However, he was later indicted by a grand jury. And so...
Did he raise the issue of his consent in his case?
Your Honor, he did. He did not raise the exact same issues I'm raising in this appeal. Mr. Neff was represented by a different attorney, and he was before a different judge. Judge Trimble refused to suppress the evidence as well. In particular, the Ballard extended detention issue was not raised in the proceedings before Judge Trimble.
So did Judge Trimble decide that his consent was valid or invalid, or did he make any decision on that?
He determined that the consent was valid. Judge Kern determined that the consent was invalid. She later retracted that decision, I think in large part because she didn't want to have a conflicting decision on the record with Judge Trimble.
This is a little bit of a side issue, but if the driver's consent has already been decided by another judge to have been valid, how does your client get to challenge that a second time?
Your Honor, it's not res judicata as to my client, because different issues were raised in that matter. The attorney for Mr. Neff did not raise the same issues that I'm raising here.
So one judge could say the driver's consent was valid, another judge could say it's invalid, and those would be permissible.
Yes. It would always be preferable to have defendants involved in the exact same traffic stop involved in proceedings before the same judge. And I attempted to get these cases consolidated. My attempt to get them consolidated was refused. So we ended up with different conclusions being drawn by different judges. So under the consent issue, my first argument was that if this was indeed an illegal detention under Ballard, then Jeremy Neff's consent is invalid per se. And again, as I discussed with you, Justice Konenkamp, that issue was never raised before Judge Trimble on behalf of the driver. The second issue is that I believe that Jeremy Neff's consent was involuntarily given, and Judge Kern did decide that. She ultimately determined that my client, Mr. Wilson, did not have standing to object to the driver's consent. I would point out here again, the officer's conduct is very telling. If the officer believed that he had a valid consent from Jeremy Neff, the normal course of events would have been for him to get Mr. Wilson out of the car, pat him down, make sure there are no weapons, secure him, and then proceed with the search. He didn't do that. Instead, he took my client over in front of his patrol vehicle and began a custodial interrogation with him in which he accused him of using drugs, in which he intimated that Jeremy Neff had already implicated my client. And it is undisputed on this appeal that that course of interrogation was illegal. It was custodial interrogation, and my client should have been Mirandized, and he was not. But why did the officer engage in that lengthy conversation with my client if he believed he already had a valid consent to search? I believe he knew he was on shaky ground, and he was looking for additional evidence that would justify the search. And that's why he interrogated my client. Under the existing South Dakota law, my client has standing to challenge the consent of the driver only if he can demonstrate that he had a legitimate expectation of privacy. Again, we've addressed this sort of ad nauseum in the briefs, but I believe, although this court has never found a defendant who had a legitimate expectation of privacy, I believe Mr. Wilson has demonstrated that in this case. Why? Because the evidence was found in an area of the car that he controlled. He claimed ownership of the evidence, and he actually pointed the law enforcement officer to the location of the evidence, found it for him.
You have 2 minutes.
So I believe that that is different from the other cases that have been decided by this court in which they have found a passenger not to have standing. But I also argue for a legitimate change, good faith change, in our existing law. I believe that the legitimate expectation of privacy standard is an anachronism that arose out of our old cases involving consent to search. It used to be when there was some question when a driver consented to search about how far that consent reached. Did it reach the glove box? Did it reach the passenger's belongings? Did it reach the trunk? We now, our law has evolved to the point that when a driver gives consent to search, it now reaches all parts of the vehicle. The Nebraska rule announced in Nebraska versus Stott is that all passengers automatically have standing to challenge the consent. And given the state of the law concerning consent, I believe that that standard now makes sense for South Dakota as well. That's because in the area of a vehicle stop, all the passengers are seized, and we recognize that. And because all the passengers are seized, they all have standing to challenge the stop. Now, under our current law, when a driver gives consent to search the vehicle, that reaches all components of the vehicle. It reaches the passengers' belongings, their purses, their backpacks, suitcases, the glove box, the trunk. And because that consent is all-encompassing, I believe that the more reasonable rule is to accord standing to all passengers to challenge the consent. It's a very unremarkable change in the law. All that I am asking is that law enforcement should have to comport themselves constitutionally. If the consent was validly given, the law enforcement officer has nothing to fear by according the passenger standing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Agstead.
May it please the court, counsel. This case raises the issues that Ms. Duffy has outlined, obviously, but the state takes a very different view, both factually and legally, of what happened here and what the result ought to be, obviously. To begin with, this is not some suspicionless car stop. Rather, it is something that's based squarely on the two statutes that the trooper cited and that are set out in the record. Judge Kern heard the trooper's testimony. She watched the videotape, and I watched the videotape. I suspect Ms. Duffy did, too. One can look at that videotape, and I think it's quite plain that you really can't see the area where the trooper said the dangling object was. At any rate, the critical thing here is that Judge Kern heard the testimony, and she found that it was appropriate that the car was stopped, both as to the dangling object and also as to this statute that says that one has to drive on the right-hand side of the roadway.
Well, if we look at the videotape and don't see it, I mean, we're essentially saying then that the trooper committed perjury, that he testified before that judge that it was there and we don't see it. So we're saying he perjured himself.
Well, possibly, Your Honor, but I think I'm comfortable that when you look at the videotape, you'll be able to tell that it really isn't that clear.
Is it standard procedure when the officer stops somebody for a dangling object that they allow them to go on and continue to drive with the dangling object hanging from the rearview mirror? Because there was testimony in this case that he never asked, he put the driver back in, let him drive the car, never removed him or never required him to remove whatever was dangling.
I don't know that there is a standard procedure, Your Honor, but the officer's testimony stated that he did not remove the dangling object, that he ordinarily didn't require people to remove dangling objects because he considered it somewhat similar to a broken windshield, and they had 10 days within which to get it fixed and get the warning ticket back to him. But that was what his testimony was. Now, as to the existence of the dangling object, as I said, I don't think you can see it on the videotape, and the officer clearly testified, and Judge Kern heard that testimony, believed the officer. As to the going over the fog line, Ms. Duffy says there are conflicts in the testimony. I don't really see that many, and if it conflicts with the testimony in the other suppression hearing, that particular suppression hearing from the Neff case is not in the record. However, at pages 24 and 25 of the suppression hearing, under cross-examination by Ms. Duffy, the officer does state that half the vehicle was over the fog line. If that's the case, then in the view of the state, the way we read the statute, it's no longer entirely on the right half of the roadway, therefore the statute is violated, and furthermore, driving with half of your car over the fog line and either on the shoulder, in the ditch, whatever, certainly raises concerns, and a law enforcement officer properly may stop just for public safety, for community caretaker, however one looks at that. So,
was it foggy that morning? Or that?
Don't believe so, no. No, right? In fact, if you look on the videotape, there are places where the sun, which had just come up, was clearly visible, and it was about 7:10 in the morning when this started.
So what's your comment on this Duffy's position that this is somewhat of a fish story in the sense that first there's half of a tire on half of the fog line, next it goes to halfway over the fog line, and then it goes from a dangling object to a couple of dangling objects to several dangling objects?
Well, I don't necessarily read the testimony in the same way, Your Honor. And it's really a matter of details. And as far as the fog line is concerned, he was pretty clear that he was over the fog line. And at the point halfway, I don't think it basically conflicts with the other testimony. As to the dangling objects, he was clear throughout that there was a dangling object. And in fact, he told the driver that quite soon after the stop was initiated, justified this to the driver at the time, and has never changed the story, basically. So it is, in our view, consistent.
How do you address the fact that these warning tickets never showed up anywhere?
I don't know that it's really significant, because the trooper got well beyond the issuing of a warning ticket, and these people were charged with felonies. So I don't know that that's all that significant. I think it would have helped if they'd been issued at the scene to indicate when the one stop was finished and the continued detention took place. But I don't really see it as significant in terms of this felony case.
There are no affidavits in the file saying that they never crossed the fog line, or that there were no dangling objects, or there was no objection on the part of the two people that were stopped to claim that the officer was mistaken.
No, I don't see anything like that in here, Your Honor. And of course, we'd hasten to add that we know that the state has the burden of proof, that the defendant never bears the burden of proof. However, in the case of suppression motions, frequently a defendant could testify or give other evidence and not have it used against him. But no, there isn't anything of that sort in the record.
So there are really no witnesses on behalf of the defense at the suppression hearing?
Don't believe so, Your Honor. No.
And when you listen to the videotape, can you hear the officer telling the driver that I stopped you because of the dangling object?
I believe that's on the oral part of the videotape, Your Honor, if I remember correctly. And of course, it's been several months since I actually looked at it, but I do believe that's on there. And so the stop being legitimate, then we continue towards the issue of the continued detention. And I want to make it clear that Judge Kern found specifically that the driver was not released pursuant to this court's Ballard case. And the state also views the holding of Ballard somewhat differently from what Ms. Duffy has outlined here this morning. That holding, I believe, is that once the driver has been finally released, then that driver must be let go. Ms. Ballard had, I think, if you look at the facts of that case, received her warning tickets, the call-in for wants and warrants and status of the vehicle had been completed. The trooper handed her the warning tickets and said, here's your warning tickets, here's your driver's license, registration, insurance card, whatever, you are free to go. That never happened here. What happened here was that at the beginning of the detention, and prior to the developing of some of the reasonable suspicion for continuing the detention based on a suspicion of drugs, at that point, the officer said, well, I'll write you a warning ticket for these violations and we will get you on down the road. But he never released him, and he had not at that time even completed those things that were necessary to issue the warning tickets and so on. And Judge Kern realized that distinction, and she not only made the finding that was proposed, but she penned in beside it the driver was not released, or Neff was not released, or something of that nature. So she was quite particular on that.
Tell me this, though. After the officer said the comment about, I'll get you on down the road, were there any additional facts that gave rise to a concern about another violation?
Now, I think, you know, I think, and I, you know, it may not be 100% clear, but my reading of the record, Your Honor, is that the observation of the pinpoint pupils, and particularly the conversation relating to drugs and drug problems and things of that nature, came after that comment. Now, I'd need to listen to the videotape to be absolutely certain of that, but I believe that the tape will bear that out. And if that's the case, then Ballard does not apply, because for that additional reason, that being that there is a additional cause that's developed after the comment has been made.
What's the significance of the pinpoint eyes?
Well, the trooper testified that in his training and experience, that was an indication of methamphetamine use. And so therefore there were physical symptoms that this driver had been using drugs. That was the testimony of it. And I don't believe that there was a lot of testimony. There was some testimony of nervousness, I believe. The major testimony of nervousness was related to Mr. Wilson, who is the defendant on appeal here, rather than to Mr. Neff, although there's some testimony about nervousness on his part. But the reasonable suspicion of methamphetamine use or of drug use was developed to some extent after the comment was made, and that having been developed, then further detention was justified, and Mr. Neff and the defendant were not released. I would state, as we stated in the brief, that the standing does not apply to these first two issues. Standing is only relevant to the last issue, because any seizure of a car constitutes a seizure of all the occupants, and they have standing to oppose that. They do not have standing, however, to oppose a search of the car when they have no possessory interest in it. They don't own it. They don't have other connections to dominion over the car, and so on. But I think what we need to do in the second issue is, first of all, the court needs to realize that there was no release under Ballard, and secondly, that additional reasonable suspicion for continuing investigation was developed, so that therefore it really isn't a Della Rosa case either, because that involved little or no continuing continuing detention. It was just a matter of running the dog around the car pretty much without reasonable suspicion. But here there is some reasonable suspicion. Continuing detention is valid, and then asking for consent, we would say, is valid. Now, as to the consent itself, it's the state's contention, that Judge Kern found below, that there was no standing in Mr. Wilson, the defendant here, to raise the consent issue, that being because he had no dominion over the vehicle, he didn't own it, it wasn't his car, and there were no other indicia of privacy or any indications that he had a right to privacy in that particular vehicle. That was the holding, and that should be, I think, sufficient to dispose of this, because under the court's existing case law, if one has no standing to raise an issue such as that, then one can't raise it. One can't object to the involuntariness of the search. And I did want to briefly address the question that Justice Konenkamp raised about the conflicting findings. And apparently there were conflicting findings on the voluntariness issue, and in a way there were. Judge Kern indicated at the end of the suppression hearing that she was ready to find the consent involuntary, where Judge Trimble in the other case had found that it was voluntary. I don't see anything impermissible in that because we have two different parties that are litigating the same thing. And of course, if you're a party to a lawsuit, even in a civil case, under res judicata principles, you have the right to litigate your case, even if someone else has gotten a different determination. So we wouldn't say that, and it might not be good that that's the way it is, but I mean, each defendant has a right.
I think it's the opposite. I'm wondering if maybe it troubles you that a judge could say that a driver gave a consent and it was invalid, the police officer extracted it from him invalidly.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, anything that was found in the car that belonged to the driver can't be used against him.
Right.
But the driver's passenger who may have something has absolutely no right to complain about it whatsoever. The passenger is left hanging.
Exactly, and that's the state's argument, Your Honor.
Does that trouble you a bit that we have a situation like that where you have a driver whose constitutional rights are just run over and the passenger has no right to complain about it?
Well, it's the driver's constitutional right. He has to raise his own rights, and as the U.S. Supreme Court and this court have recognized time and time again, a Fourth Amendment search and seizure right is a personal right that must be raised by someone who has had his rights violated.
Getting into a car, just getting into someone else's car as a passenger, is a complete abdication of all your rights. If the same two people walking down the sidewalk, and one gave consent to a search, he can't give consent to himself. But by the two being in the car now, all of a sudden, the person who has no intention of giving consent loses all of his rights.
Well, I don't think that's the case. He has all rights that he continues to have, but one of those rights just is not preventing the search of the car. But unlike what Ms. Duffy said, and she may have misspoken, he has the right to stop his person from being searched at all times. If he'd gotten out of the car, the trooper could not search his person without his consent or without some other exception to the warrant requirement. But the car itself is something that he has no rights in because it isn't his car, he has no dominion over it, and therefore he has no standing to raise the driver's rights. But it is, I'd emphasize, the driver's rights we're talking about here.
But
the driver's rights.
The passenger had a purse. The officer says, I want everybody to get out of the car, and the passenger left her purse in the car. That would be searched, not because she gave consent, but because the driver gave consent.
And I'm not sure about that, Your Honor, but I think that was considered in the court's Cadney case, which was another one that I argued before the court several years ago, and it seems that the court said that the driver could not consent to searching her purse, but she may have actually taken it with her.
And she wanted to take it with her, and the officer wouldn't let her do it,
okay.
And searched it.
And then I think that at that point they said the driver could not consent to that because it was something that was her personal property. Now in this instance, there wasn't a search of any kind of an enclosed container that was associated with the defendant. Rather, what ended up happening is that some items that were obviously contraband on first glance that the defendant actually ended up claiming. There were three or four syringes, I think, and some suspicious powder that turned out to be methamphetamine, some marijuana, a marijuana pipe. Those things were all in the wide open as soon as they were found.
And so it wasn't obvious that they belonged to either one. The only way the officer knew that the passenger owned them is the passenger admitted that he owned them.
He admitted to it, and that's the only way that the officer knew that. Now, of course, the officer did have the passenger pull it out from the seat and give it to him, and the officer's explanation for that was that he had seen a syringe cap, a needle cap, lying between the door and the seat, and the car was filthy and dirty, and there were shoes and garbage and everything in it, and he figured it would be quite hazardous to him to start reaching around because needle sticks, all those sorts of things. So he actually did have Mr. Wilson hand him the items. But he'd have certainly, any kind of a search at all, certainly would have found those, and so it was not a matter of his constitutional rights being violated. But under the standing doctrine, Mr. Neff, or Mr. Wilson, rather, can make no claim to dominion over any part of the car. He had no interest in it, and these items were just were found in the car. Now, his...
You have approximately a minute left.
Okay. I just wanted to emphasize on the standing matter that even though there's a claim of ownership of the materials, A, they were contraband, and that would have been obvious immediately to the officer, and B, the ownership was not obvious, just as it wasn't in this court's Krebs case. And based on these arguments, other arguments that we've set out in the brief, Your Honor, we'd request that this court affirm the trial court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Agstead. Ms. Duffy, you have 10 minutes.
Okay, please, the court. Briefly, as to the some of the issues with regard to the validity of the stop itself, Justice Konenkamp, you indicated that a reversal on this case would essentially be a judgment by this court that the officer committed perjury.
Well, I asked that question.
Yeah, I don't think that that's necessarily the conclusion, and I don't think that's what happened in this case. I do not think that this officer intentionally perjured himself. But I think officers make dozens of stops every week, and this testimony came 4 months after the initial stop, and maybe by the time he even sat down to write his report that night, his memory of the facts had blurred.
But the counsel says that even on the videotape, you can hear the officer telling the driver, I stopped you because of the dangling object.
Yes, and I think the driver's failure to contradict him on that point is entirely understandable. He's driving in a car that he knows has methamphetamine in it, and the officer says, I'm just going to give you a warning ticket for this dangling object, and then I'm going to get you on down the road. And he's saying to himself, phew, thank God, I'm not going to argue with him about the existence of a dangling object because I'm going to get out of here. I think that's entirely understandable that he did not contradict the officer under those circumstances.
But once he has counsel, and it comes up for a motion, suppression motion, or whatever, he could have put an affidavit in, or in fact even testified on the stand just to that limited point that there was no dangling object, couldn't he? And he could do it in safety without waiving his rights to...
He could have, Your Honor, and I am at a loss to understand why defense counsel in criminal cases don't use their own client's testimony more often in suppression hearings. Because, as you know, the rule of law is that that testimony cannot be used against you at trial. I can't speak to why Mr. Branken did not have Mr. Neff testify as to that limited issue. I know I've sat in courtrooms before when a defendant takes the stand in the suppression hearing and testifies as to a limited issue, and then the prosecutor gets up and begins to cross-examine him about a whole array of other issues, and the objection is raised, you know, this is beyond the scope of direct. And I've seen judges overrule that. And so perhaps that helps inform defense counsel's reticence to put their client on the stand.
Right, but still then they could use an affidavit, couldn't they?
Yes, they could, Your Honor. And I can't speak to why that wasn't done in Mr. Branken's case. The officer in this case excused his failure to remove the dangling object by saying, well, this is like a broken windshield. I give him 10 days to fix it. But the point of this is that this is not like a broken windshield. A lay person cannot repair their broken windshield by the side of the road. A dangling object violation can be remedied immediately, right then and there, at the side of the road. I think that the officer's conduct belies the existence of that dangling object. Mr. Eichstead suggested that the Neff testimony was not in the record. In fact, it was read into the record during the suppression hearing on pages 24 carrying over to 25. I read the law enforcement officer's testimony to him from the Neff hearing. I asked him if I had read that accurately. He indicated that I had, and that basically he didn't see any difference between his testimony at Neff and his testimony in the Wilson case. Even though in the Neff case he said one half of one tire crossed the fog line, and at Wilson he said one half of the entire vehicle. Justice Konenkamp, you had asked whether additional facts arose after the officer told the driver, I'm going to get you on down the road. The answer to that question is unequivocally no. You can look at the transcript of the suppression hearing at pages 8, lines 8 through 16, and page 10, lines 2 through 5. All of the elements that the officer observed that led him to suspect that the driver was using drugs were observed before he made that statement. He had no intention of letting Neff go when he told him he was going to let him go. He told him that in an effort to get him to consent to a search that he would not otherwise have consented to. Justice Meyer-Henry, you asked what the significance was of the pinpoint pupils, and I addressed that at the suppression hearing in my cross-examination of the officer. The DSM-IV actually indicates that dilated pupils, not constricted pupils, are indicative of meth use. And in the video, you can clearly see this is at 7 a.m. on a winter morning, and the sun has just come up over the horizon. And the driver, in fact, says to the officer, "Ma'am, that sun is blinding me." I don't know whether constricted pupils are important in this case or not. I think there's another explanation for why his pupils were pinpoint. He was staring directly into the sun. But in any case, to the extent that that provides probable cause, that was acknowledged and observed by the officer before he told this man he was going to get him on down the road. On the standing issue, I think that South Dakota needs to change their rule as to standing and to accord standing to passengers in a vehicle. If two young people from Mount Marty College were stopped at 2 a.m. in the morning here in Yankton because they had a dangling object in their vehicle, and the officer invited the driver back to his patrol vehicle and ran the records checks with dispatch, and dispatch gave the all clear, and then the officer said to the driver, "Will you let me search your car, and if you don't, I'm going to beat you up," that would clearly be an involuntary consent to search. Here in Yankton, under our current law, unless the passenger was part owner on the title of the vehicle or had a spare key to the vehicle and drove it every other day, this court would not recognize the passenger's standing to challenge that consent. If those exact same facts took place just over the bridge into Nebraska, the passenger would have standing to challenge that clearly invalid consent. All we are asking is that South Dakota defendants be accorded the same dignity and constitutional rights as passengers in Nebraska cars.
Is Nebraska the only state that recognizes that, though, or are there other states?
You know, Your Honor, I did not do a review of all 50 states. Nebraska is a neighboring state, and we typically look to our neighboring states, and so that's as far as I went. You know, I noticed in reading the biographies of the justices that sit here before this audience that three of you are former prosecutors. And I know you understand the importance of having honest law enforcement officers. Honest law enforcement officers are the foundation of our criminal justice system. And to the extent you allow that foundation to erode, you affect the rest of the structure. Please hold under the Ballard issue that this extended detention was illegal, that the consent given was invalid, and reverse and remand with instructions for this evidence to be suppressed.
Thank you, Ms. Dillon. This concludes the October term of this court, and we've just had a wonderful experience here being hosted by Mount Marty College. We'd like to thank President Berry, his executive assistant, Ms. Carla Heng, for all the help that they have been throughout the process of the planning and then the holding of this term of court. The faculty and staff of this institution have been wonderful. The students who have assisted us, we greatly appreciate that. We thank the Highway Patrol for providing security, and it's just been a wonderful experience for us, and we hope for you spectators it's also been a wonderful experience for you. With that, we are in recess.